Daniel chapter 11 in your Bibles is where we're headed. Daniel chapter 11. Tonight I have good news for you and I have bad news. The news is about history and the news is about the future. Where did I get this news? Well, I got this news from God's writing of truth, God's book of truth. You see, there is a book in heaven where God has written down in detail what will come about in the future. I'm not talking about the Bible. I'm talking about a book that is in heaven where God has written down the events that are yet to come. You say, well, boy, Mike, where did you get a hold of this book? This is going to be pretty handy. Well, I didn't get a hold of it, but I read about it in the book of Daniel. Turn in your Bibles to Daniel chapter 10, verse 21. Daniel 10, 21, there's an angel. And he's come to Daniel. Daniel's been praying. And the angel comes to Daniel. He's going to tell him about the future. And here he tells him where he got his information. Daniel 10:21. However, the angel says to Daniel, I will tell you what is inscribed in the writing of truth. Yet there is no one who stands firmly with me against these forces except Michael, your prince. Now, in Daniel chapter 11, we're going to see what the angel told to Daniel. Things that were future to him. And the things that are written in this book of truth are so detailed and specific about the future that sometimes it's a little boring. As you walk through this, what's in here? What part of the book of truth does the angel give to Daniel? Well, the first 35 verses of Daniel are about specific events that were future to Daniel, but now they're passed to us. So it's when we're reading it, we're going to be looking at prophecies that have already come true. The title of the sermon that was in the bulletin this morning, I like to change it so you can pick which title you like better. And in the morning, it said 135 prophecies fulfilled. And in Daniel chapter 11, verses 1 through 35, there are 135 specific things that Daniel said would happen in this order, and it all came true. We know that because we can look at history and see it just match the history books. But we know Daniel wrote these things before they happened. It's pretty amazing. And then, after Daniel 11:35, we won't get this far tonight, but starting in verse 36 and into chapter 12, the angel continues with the things that he saw inscribed in the book of truth. But those things are future to us. It's things about the Antichrist that's to come. And those things are going to happen just as surely and just as specifically as the things that we'll read about tonight that already did happen. Okay, good news and bad news. The good news is this, we'll see this tonight, that both history and the future are not random, but they have been determined by God. God has determined what's going to happen, and he has set it up in detail. If he wants to, he can send an angel and tell us exactly what's going to happen. He can walk down through all the states yet to come in the election and say, this person will win this one, and this person will win this one. And will it be all of those details he could spell out for us? It's already determined. That's good news. God's determined it. More good news. Not only has God determined the events of the future, but God has determined the end to which it's headed. And for those of us who know Jesus Christ, this end is glorious. It's glorious beyond description because Jesus Christ is going to come back and we'll get to share in his glory. This is where all of these details go. That's the good news. I also have some bad news. And this is kind of what the angel was coming to tell Daniel about. You see, Daniel had been praying because the Jews, he knew by what was written in Jeremiah that it was time for the Jews to go back to the land. And so Daniel had prayed that they could. And they did go back to the land. But now Daniel's getting word from back in Jerusalem that actually things aren't going so great in Jerusalem. It took them a long time even to get the temple rebuilt there. And Daniel's thinking, well, Lord, and I think this is what's prompting his prayer here that prompts the angel to come. Daniel's praying, well, Lord, is this? I thought we were getting close to the end. How much more suffering are we going to have to go through? And so the angel comes, and the answer is a lot. There's a lot of suffering to come, right? And so he spells out for him all these things that have to happen because they are inscribed in the writing of truth. And so if we pay attention tonight, we'll learn something about human history. You see, the period before us, what we're studying tonight, is marked by humanity fighting and suffering. The period that is after us, that we'll read about in a couple of weeks, that's marked by humanity fighting and suffering. So, now here in Daniel, he skips over our time period, so I can't really tell you what is inscribed in the Book of Truth for tomorrow, because Daniel doesn't tell us. But I think by looking at what happens in the past, and right before our time period, and what happens right after us, I think we could pretty accurately guess what our period is going to be made up of. It's going to be humanity fighting and suffering. So, there's your bad news. Okay, so how do we apply this to ourselves? I want to give the application up front, and then we'll talk about it more as we go through. It's in italics on your sheet. If you find yourself surrounded by fighting and suffering, know that God is still in control. Even in this, even in all of this, you can trust Him. Trust Him and live for what matters. Trust Him and live for what matters. Okay, so here in Daniel 11, the angel is just going to unload on Daniel a bucket full of details about the future. And every detail comes true. When I do Q&A with the Awana kids, a lot of times one of the questions that I get from TNT is, tell us about some prophecies that have come true in the Bible. And that's always fun to do, especially in those times. I always try to pick prophecies that came true about Jesus and His life. Well, here's another place we could go. We want prophecies that have come true. Daniel 11 gives you a whole lot of them really fast. But what we see by this is God ordains what happens in history. Now, God ordains this, but as we go through it, you're going to see it is a terrible mess. This is not happy. This is not how human government ought to work, and yet God planned it. He said, this is what will happen, and then this person will come, and they'll do this horrible thing, and they'll do this horrible thing back to them, and that's how this is going to flow. And yet, this is all ordained by God. All this fighting and suffering, this terrible mess of human history, spells out just like God happened, just like God said it was going to happen. Now, you may, as we go along here, say, well, Mike, why bother? Couldn't you just tell us, Mike, there's a bunch of historical people, there's a bunch of historical details, and I went and looked them up, and they all happened, and we could just move to the what's coming in the future? Yeah, we could. We could, but that would be too easy, right? And so, why go through and check all of these and see that it actually happened? The answer is, when we get to the part that's in the future, a lot of people say, well, that's not going to really happen. And so I want us to have confidence that we walk through all of these things that Daniel prophesied that happened, and then it happened, and it happened exactly like he said, so that by the time we get to what's coming in the future, we're like, okay, we get it. Whatever God says is going to come exactly like that, because everything that He said in the past happened. Right? That's the confidence that we want to build by walking through this. So you ready? Take a breath. Here we go. We're diving into what is inscribed in the Book of Truth. Okay, there's four main periods that are talked about. The first one is Persia falling to Alexander the Great. Look at Daniel chapter 11, verse 2. Here's where the truth starts to be revealed. And now, the angel says, I will tell you, Daniel, the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. Then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them. As soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. Okay, slide number one. When Daniel receives this revelation, the king of Persia is Cyrus the Great, and we have a picture of him. See there, Cyrus, good-looking fellow up there. I put the start of his reign at 539. That's not when he started in Persia, but when he took over Babylon. But Daniel is writing this in the third year of Cyrus, so it would be about 536 when Daniel receives this information. And the angel says to him, there's three more kings that are going to arise. That'd be Cambyses and Gautama and Darius. And you can read about these guys in history. Or you can go, like I did, to Wikipedia and look really scholarly. Here's their pictures, right? So Cambyses, I think, is this guy. And we skip over Gautama. And then there's Darius. And this is Xerxes here. So three more are going to arise. And then he says, a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them. That's Xerxes. And as soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. Okay, Xerxes. there in Persia, Xerxes is Esther's husband. Well, we read about him in Esther. We don't find greatly flattering things about his character in Esther, but we find him. In Esther, he's called Ahasuerus, but it's the same fellow, Xerxes the first, the ruler of Persia. Now, it says that he is going to arouse the empire against the realm of Greece. He lives in Persia. Greece is off to the west. You see, Xerxes' father, Darius, had attacked Greece and failed. Just been rebuffed and had to go back with his tails between his legs back to Persia. And Persia is the ruler of the world, and so Persia shouldn't be losing, right? So Xerxes is going to try again. And that's what he does when he becomes rich and powerful. He pulls together an amazing army. Herodotus, the historian, says that Xerxes' army that he attacked Greece with was 1 million men. I mean, that's a huge army. And Xerxes, initially when he started attacking Greece, he had some victories, but eventually he failed and was driven out of Greece again. And really, the only thing that Xerxes accomplished when he attacked Greece was making the Greek people hate the Persians. And this hatred for the Persians between the Greeks and the Persians is going to simmer for generations. And we just skip over those generations as far as we're concerned, but we're trying to track the line that gets us to Greece. So there were more kings of Persia, but we skip them. Between verses 2 and 3, there's a time gap, and we go down to the rise of a new Greek king, Alexander the Great. Slide 2. There's Alexander, good-looking fellow. I'm sure that's exactly what he looked like. Alexander the Great, he's going to be talked about in verse 3. Okay, Daniel 11:3, and a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. Alexander conquered much of the known world in a 3-year sprint, took over all of Persia, which was the greatest kingdom ever that had been, in 3 years. And then, suddenly, Alexander, at a young age, when he just conquered the world, contracted a fever and died. That's referred to there in verse 4 as well. Go to the next slide after the third slide, yeah. Look at verse 4. But as soon as he, Alexander, has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others besides him. Okay, Alexander died. And then it says that his kingdom is going to be parceled out to the four points of the compass. And that is what happened with the Greek kingdom after Alexander died. It was split up into four parts. He had four generals, and they divided amongst them. Not peacefully, they were fighting for this, but this is eventually what happened. Cassander took the area that's in purple there. Lysimachus took what's in green. Ptolemy took what's in pink. And Seleucus is orange on the map. And they continue to fight. The map changed year by year. They're warring for Alexander's great empire. But just as it says here, it didn't go to his own descendants. His sons were both murdered. And the kingdom fell apart right after he had conquered it. So Persia falls to Alexander the Great. That's the first thing that happens. Now, the next thing that Daniel's going to talk about, that the angel tells Daniel in the Book of Truth, he's going to give him a history of the Seleucids battling the Ptolemies. The Seleucids battling the Ptolemies. From verse 5 all the way down through verse 20, that's what this is. Okay, go to the next slide. You can't see this super well. Maybe this picture's better. Can you see that the blue kind of ends here? So, two of these generals. You got the Ptolemies down here, and you have the Seleucids up here. And in the verses that are going to come, the king of the north is going to refer to the king who is in charge of the Seleucid Empire. The king of the south is going to refer to the people down in Egypt, the Ptolemies. Now, why would we focus in on these two? I mean, there's the Antigonid Empire over there. There's the rest of the world happening in different places. The reason that we care about these guys is that Daniel was asking God, what's going to happen with my people? Is there a lot more suffering that we have to go through? And the answer is going to be yes. And what area, what land lies right in between the Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemaic Empire? Israel, right? Israel, Jerusalem, they are smack dab in the middle. I was reading this week, I didn't know this. When I picture Israel, I just picture barrenness, you know, kind of desert, and it's just not. I don't think I want to go there on vacation and sit under the trees. There's just a lot of barrenness. But I guess that if Israel was in its natural state, it would look more like a pine forest, like the Rocky Mountains kind of area. And why does it not look like that? It's because down through the centuries, this army has come through and destroyed it. And this army comes through and destroys it. And this army comes through and destroys it. And doesn't ever get time to build back up again to what it ought to have been. Well, that's what happens in this time period. The north comes down and the south goes up and they all battle in the middle around God's people. Okay. Now, to help us keep track of what's being said here, I've got this chart. I got this out of the English Standard Version Study Bible. And by the time you leave tonight, I expect you all to have this memorized. So pay close attention. No. But I think it's going to be helpful to us. Because he keeps saying the king of the north, the king of the south. These guys here, these are the kings of the north. This doesn't all happen in one generation. The king of the north could be him, and then it's going to be him, and then him. It walks down through. The king of the south, these are the Ptolemies over here. And we find about how they fight each other and trample Israel in the meantime. Right? Okay, so verse 5, we're jumping into this. Verse 5, then the king of the south, that'd be Egypt area, that's the Ptolemies, the guys on the left. Then the king of the south will grow strong. Okay, that's the first Ptolemy Soter up there. He had been a highly capable general under Alexander. He was one of the great generals under Alexander, so that's why he ends up with Egypt being his area. Verse 5, the king of the south will grow strong along with one of his princes, who will gain ascendancy over him and obtain dominion. His dominion will be a great dominion indeed. Okay, one of his princes. This is Seleucus. Seleucus, is there a map that comes right after this? Or maybe it's before this? Okay, yeah. Okay, Seleucus, when things were being split up, Seleucus was supposed to be in charge. He was given a satrapy over Babylon, but things didn't go well there. There was this other general that came along and defeated him. And so Seleucus had to run for safety. And so Seleucus, one of his princes in verse 5, he goes and he hides down in under Ptolemy's protection in Egypt. But after a while, the guy who was in Babylon that drove Seleucid out got kicked out, and so Seleucid gets to go back to his homeland. That's what it says in verse 5 there. See that? One of his princes, one of the king of the south's princes, will gain ascendancy over him and obtain dominion. His dominion will be great indeed. So Seleucid eventually goes back home, and his kingdom grows, and it grows, and it grows, and it grows, until the Seleucid Empire is the largest of the four, even greater than Ptolemy's empire had been, even though he had to hide under him for a while. Okay, go back to the previous slide, Greg. Thanks. Okay, verse 6. It says, after some years, they will form an alliance. They'll form an alliance. Well, this alliance actually happened in a later generation. We've skipped down now to the second king of the south and the north. So you have Antiochus and you have Ptolemy. These two guys make an alliance. And look in verse 6 how it says this alliance is going to happen. Okay, now this seems like, okay, this is history. Why are we studying this again? But remember, Daniel said all this stuff hundreds of years before it happened. And then we look at history and it happens this way. So verse 6, they're going to make an alliance. In the middle of verse 6, it says, the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north to carry out a peaceful arrangement. Okay, the daughter of the king of the south is Berenice here. And to make peace, Berenice gets to marry over to the other side. Supposed to marry Antiochus II. And the plan was, well, then if we marry together, then the offspring gets to be king of both of these lands. And so it's kind of a way of consolidating their forces. This is all great. So the daughter of the king of the south, Berenice, she comes over, she marries Antiochus II. And they're going to have an heir. Right? This is wonderful. The only hitch in their plan is that Antiochus is already married. And his wife is powerful, and she's not real keen on him marrying somebody else and handing off the kingdom to her son. So Laodice gets kind of upset, and let's see what happens. Verse 6, they make this peaceful arrangement. But then it says, but she, that's Berenice, right, that married over here, she will not retain her position of power, nor will he remain in his power, but she will be given up along with those who brought her in and the one who sired her, as well as those who supported her in those times. Essentially what happens, Laodice murders Berenice and her husband Antiochus and the son that they had that was supposed to be in charge of everything. And Laodice then takes over. She is now the regent of the north because the king, her husband, died and he deserved it. He shouldn't be going off marrying other women, right? So that's what's happening here. Laodice took over. And this is exactly what Daniel said would happen. It was written in the book of truth. Okay. Verse 7, the her is going to be talking about Berenice, this murdered sister of the southern guy. Okay, Berenice is going to be the her in verse 7. Okay. But one of the descendants of her line will arise in his place. Mine says descendants. Really, it could say relatives. Literally, it says it's the branch of her roots. Okay, so it's not her descendant that's talked about in this verse, because she doesn't have any descendants. They're dead, right? She and her son got murdered. Her brother, however, Ptolemy, is the one who's talked about this. He's going to arise. And what do you think Berenice's brother wants to do now that his sister has been murdered by the other side? He wants to avenge the death of his sister. And so that's what he does. That's what you guys would do, right? Yes, okay, good. But one of the descendants of her line will arise in his place, and he will come. So from the south they're going to attack. They're going to come against their army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he will deal with them and display great strength. Also their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold he will take into captivity to Egypt, and he on his part will refrain from attacking the king of the north for some years. Okay, so Ptolemy the Third here, to avenge his sister's death, attacks the north. He captures and loots the capital, which is Antioch. He puts Laodice, his sister's murderer, to death, and he seizes gods and valuables from up north. Now, this makes him extremely popular because the way they got those gods and valuables up north, back in the Persian kingdom under Cambyses, Cambyses went into Egypt, he raided and he stole all of Egypt's gods. He took them back up north. Okay, now when Ptolemy the Third goes and attacks up north, he gets Egypt's old gods and he takes them back to them in Egypt. So now the people of Egypt really love Ptolemy. And they give him a new name, Ptolemy Euergetes, which means Ptolemy the Benefactor, because he's brought back to them their precious treasures from centuries earlier, their ancestors. Okay, after this, Ptolemy the Third and Seleucus the Second, now, this is Laodice's son and Antiochus's, not the son they had with Berenice, because he's dead, but Seleucus, they make a peace treaty. And he and his part, it says at the end of verse 8, it says, he on his part refrained from attacking for some years. Verse 9, then the latter, the king of the north, will enter the realm of the king of the south, but return to his own land. So somewhere in here, Seleucus attacks the south, doesn't have much success, and goes back to his own land. Okay, now, verse 10. His sons, okay, so we're looking at Seleucus's sons. We're skipping down another generation to get to verse 10. They will mobilize and assemble a multitude of great forces. Seleucus the Third and Antiochus the Third continue their wars with the Ptolemies. Seleucus was murdered after a 3-year reign, and so Antiochus continued the warring. And Antiochus is called the Great here because of his military successes. That's in verse 10, his military successes. And one of them, that's Antiochus the Third, the Great, one of them will keep on coming and overflow and pass through that he may again wage war up to his very fortress. Okay, so yay, the north is winning. But now we're going to have a comeback by the south. This is how this goes, right? We're just fighting back and forth between the Ptolemies and Seleucids. And every time, the Israelites get trampled in the middle. Verse 11 and 12 refer to a counterattack against Antiochus the Third by Ptolemy the Fourth. I'm trying not to put a P on this. In my mind, every time it's Ptolemy. I think that's the first time I did it. Nobody noticed until I pointed it out. Verse 11. The king of the south will be enraged and go forth and fight with the king of the north. Then the latter, the king of the north, will raise a great multitude, but that multitude will be given into the hand of the former. When the multitude is carried away, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cause tens of thousands to fall. Okay, so the south comes to attack, and the north is supposed to raise a great army, and that's what happened. We can read about this in history. Ptolemy had an army of from the south. He had 70,000 infantry, 5,000 cavalry, and 73 elephants against Antiochus's 62,000 infantry, 6,000 cavalry, and 102 elephants. But whoever has more elephants wins, right? I mean, that's just, it doesn't matter about the rest of the stuff. So the guy with more elephants from the north wins. No, I said it wrong. The south won. So, okay, Ptolemy wins, even though he has less elephants. The dust clears. The elephants are dead. Tens of thousands of northern troops are slain, like it says here, right? When he will cause tens of thousands to fall, it's tens of thousands of northern troops, because once the elephants were gone, there was no more hope. But that point, okay, now, so, and it says his heart will be lifted up. So the southern guy, Ptolemy, he has won this great battle over this great army. But then you notice at the end of verse 12, it says, yet he will not prevail. This here, this battle, is the high point in the Ptolemaic wars with the Seleucids. At this point now, the tide is going to start swinging north. And so Ptolemy's happy for now. Go to verse 13. For the king of the north will again raise a greater multitude than the former, the one that just got destroyed. Yeah, it takes a while because you got to raise all new elephants, you know. And after an interval of some years, he will press on with a great army and much equipment. Okay, it's 15 years later. It says, after an interval of some years, 15 years later, Antiochus III sees his chance to attack again. And what happened, what prompted him to attack, was his old enemy Ptolemy IV dies. And Ptolemy IV hands on his kingdom to his son. The reason that Antiochus thinks that this is going to work in his favor is that Ptolemy V, the new king of Egypt, he's five. And so the king of the north figures, okay, he's five. I should be able to outmaneuver him, right? And so this is his plan. I'm going to get a new army like I had before. I'm going to go fight against this five-year-old, and we're going to take him out. So that's what happens. The king of the north sweeps southward. And now verse 14, they're sweeping southward, so they're sweeping through where? Through Israel. And verse 14 mentions some violent Jews that rise up. The violent Jews actually take the right side. They side with Antiochus. Instead of siding with the five-year-old, they figure this is the right side to be on. But it doesn't go well with them because they side too early with the north. And they're going to get attacked by the south before the northern guy gets there with his army. Look in verse 14. That's what happens. Now in those times, many will rise up against the king of the south. The violent ones among your people, he's talking to Daniel, will also lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they will fall down. You can read about that in history. There's this general from the south, Scopas. He can't stand against the Antiochus rushing in from the north. But before Antiochus gets there, he goes and he fights against these Jews who are siding with the north, and he wipes them out. The violent ones amongst the people. You wonder, are they just violent like they like to fight? Or are they violent against the Lord? Are these wicked Jews? We're not sure, but the Jews that sided with the north, they get taken out just like it was predicted. Then Antiochus comes in with his new army to attack the little kid in the south, right? Verse 15. Then the king of the north will come, cast up a siege ramp and capture a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south will not stand their ground, not even their choicest troops, for there will be no strength to make a stand. The well-fortified city there is Sidon. Scopas was coming up, and he's fighting, and he lost. And so he fled into Sidon. He heard of Tyre and Sidon. He fled there, and he was holed up in Sidon for a while. But eventually, like it says, there was no strength to make a stand. And the north wins again. Okay, so we've got Antiochus III. He's won this great victory against the little kid in the south, Ptolemy V. I don't know if you can brag about that too much. Like, hooray! I outmaneuvered an elementary school student. All right, verse 16. I always beat Ethan at chess every time we play. So, verse 16. But he who comes against him, this is still talking about the guy from the north, he who comes against him will do as he pleases, and no one will be able to withstand him. He will also stay for a time in the beautiful land with destruction in his hand. The beautiful land is Israel, right? From Daniel's perspective. And so on his way down, Antiochus for a while stays in Israel with destruction in his hand. The destruction in his hand was against those who sided with the south, because he's the northern king. So he wipes out some of them. But really, for the Jews as a whole, this wasn't the worst. There's a lot worse things than this that are coming. Okay, then verse 17. Still talking about Antiochus III. Verse 17, he will set his face to come with the power of his whole kingdom, bringing with him a proposal of peace, which he will put into effect. So Antiochus III, with his large and victorious army behind him, forms terms of peace, forces terms of peace upon the south. You can do that when you have a large army and you've already beaten your enemy. So he says, okay, here's my terms of peace. They're like, okay. Now part of Antiochus's plan, part of his terms of peace, and this is strange, I don't know if I've ever heard of this anywhere else in history. His terms of peace with Ptolemy V is that Ptolemy V had to take his daughter in marriage. Right? I defeated you at war, and so I got this daughter. I know she's quite a bit older than you, but you have to take her in marriage. That is what happens. And her name, Antiochus' daughter that he leaves here with Ptolemy, her name is Cleopatra I. This is not the same Cleopatra that you're thinking of. She comes later. This is the first Cleopatra. All right, so Antiochus' daughter marries Ptolemy. He's about 10 now, but Antiochus really isn't. It's not just that he can't get his daughter married off, and this is the only way that he can think of to do it. He actually has plans against the south in this. Do you see that in verse 17? Daniel 11:17 says, he'll set his face to come with the power of his whole kingdom, bringing with him a proposal of peace, which he will put into effect. He will also give him the daughter of women to ruin it. To ruin what? He's planning to ruin the south by Cleopatra. He figures that his daughter will stay loyal to him, and she can work against the south while she's down there, and she's like 15 years older than her husband, and so she should be able to kind of order him around, and this way he can run the world until his daughter has a son with the king of the south, and then basically that'll be his grandson, and so he's taking over the south by this. This is his plan. However, his plan doesn't work. You see that at the end of verse 17? But she will not take a stand for him or be on his side. And that's what happened in history. Cleopatra loved her nice little husband. She loved him dearly. And so she's just like, well, I don't care what daddy says. She sided with the south. She basically just becomes southern. And so his plan for world domination by marrying off his daughter backfired. So if you were thinking about doing that, I wouldn't recommend it. All right. So verse 18, we're still talking about Antiochus III over here up north. After he married off Cleopatra, then he will turn his face to the coastlands and capture many. But a commander will put a stop to his scorn against him. Moreover, he will repay him for his scorn. Okay, Antiochus, he continued to experience victory, to expand his territory, until he ran into Rome. The commander that defeated him, his name was Lucius Cornelius Scipio. This Roman commander defeated Antiochus, chased him back into Antiochus' own territory, and then defeated him again in Smyrna. So Antiochus was sweeping through. He was conquering the world until he ran into Rome like a brick wall. Then he ran, and Rome chased him. And eventually, it says at the end of verse 18, he, the commander, will repay him for his scorn. It would have been better for him not to attack Rome. Now, he's forced to surrender territory. He was forced to hand over his entire elephant brigade and all of his navy. And he was pledged to pay heavy taxes. Now he has to every year give this huge tribute to Rome. And he had to surrender 20 hostages. One of the hostages that he had to surrender to Rome was his son, Antiochus IV Epiphanes. We all wish that Antiochus IV Epiphanes would have stayed in Rome. But originally he's taken off as a captive there. We'll hear from him later on in the chapter. Okay, so we come to verse 19. Now, Antiochus III is not so happy. He's just been humbled by Rome, and now he has to come up with money. Verse 19, so he will turn his face toward the fortresses of his own land, but he will stumble and fall and be found no more. So Antiochus, he's back at home. He needs to come up with this huge tribute to Rome every year. And so the only plan that he could come up with to get enough resources to give to the Romans was to rob the temples of his people. Because in there, they had wealth, they had golden gods and things. And so he would break into the temples. Our translation calls it fortresses. But he would break into their temples, he would steal their gods, and he would give them to Rome to pay his taxes because they beat him. Well, that didn't go well. When he went to this one city called Elymais, he wanted to pillage the temple of Bel. He was there with his soldiers. And the citizens became so angry that he was going to steal their god that they stormed Antiochus' troops and they murdered their king. Which is exactly what happens, said would happen, right? Verse 19, he will stumble and fall and be found no more. So we come to verse 20. Then, in Antiochus' place, will arise one who will send an oppressor through the jewel of his kingdom. Yet within a few days he will be shattered, though not in anger nor in battle. Antiochus' son, Antiochus IV, can't rule. He's not next in line anyway, but he's off in Rome. Next in line is Seleucus. So when Antiochus is murdered by the angry mob, they didn't like him stealing their gods, Seleucus takes over, and it says that he will send an oppressor through the jewel of his kingdom. Seleucus IV had a tax collector named Heliodorus. He sent this man, Heliodorus, throughout his kingdom because he's got this tribute he's got to pay to Rome every year. And so Heliodorus, if someone's going to get angry and the angry mob is going to kill someone, let's have it be the tax collector that get killed, right? So it's Heliodorus' job now to raid the temples, and Seleucus stays safely back behind. This is his plan. And the jewel of his kingdom, right? It says, one will arise in his place, send an oppressor through the jewel of his kingdom. Well, what would, from Daniel's perspective, what would be the jewel of the northern kingdom? Well, it's Jerusalem. It's Israel. Specifically, if you're going to rob a temple, there's a lot of wealth in the temple at Jerusalem. 2 Maccabees talks about this when Heliodorus came to plunder the Lord's temple for his taxes. Now, these apocryphal books, 2 Maccabees, 1 Maccabees, we're not sure if all of the things that happened in there are absolutely true. It's not part of the Bible. But the story that's in here, and it could be true, Heliodorus came to plunder the Lord's temple, but Heliodorus, when he got close to doing it, he got this vision of mighty angels attacking and flogging him. And he thought, nah, I won't take those gods. And so he didn't actually plunder the temple, although he was coming to do it. Okay, Seleucus then, the Book of Truth says he's going to be shattered within a few days, though not in anger nor in battle. A few days, you could translate a few years, that's probably what you should do. He had a short reign, Seleucus did. And then he died, but he wasn't killed in anger like his dad was by that angry mob, remember? He wasn't killed in battle, he was poisoned by his tax collector, Heliodorus. Didn't appreciate having to do all the hard work. Maybe, and we're not sure what Heliodorus' motives were for poisoning him. It could be that Heliodorus wanted to run the place, because he basically already is. Or maybe Heliodorus is working in cahoots with Antiochus IV, because that's the kind of guy Antiochus IV was. We don't know, but somehow he poisons him, and now he dies, not in anger nor in battle, but in whatever happens when you get poisoned. All right, so the predictions of truth. You read this, and it's like, okay, well, the predictions just roll on in detail without error, and the events now are 370 years after Daniel predicted them. Well, how in the world did he know that all this stuff was going to happen? Well, it's written. See? It's written in the Book of Truth, and what's written in the Book of Truth happens. All of these details. Now is when things are going to get really intense for the Jewish people. We'll save most of this for next time. But the next thing we're going to learn about, Antiochus IV Epiphanes is going to come back from Rome, and he's going to be the most wicked oppressor of the Jewish people until the Antichrist. Maybe Hitler would you throw in there about Antiochus IV's level. Tonight, though, we're going to... And then in later on in Daniel, he's going to talk about the Antichrist himself coming. So for Daniel, there's a lot of suffering that's going to happen for his people. God's spelling it out for him. Now we've read of murder, intrigue, battle, power plays, destruction, war, poisonings. And what's accomplished by all of this is, what progress has humanity made in the wars of the Seleucids and the Ptolemies? Ian Duguid says this: it is the story, continual story, of wars and rumors of wars. As one human ruler and empire after another seeks to gain power by cunning or force. Yet though the tide in the affairs of men comes in and goes out, in the end, it accomplishes precisely nothing. The balance of power, he continues, in earthly politics may shift, but it never comes to permanent rest. Daniel 11 shows us the fallen world pursuing the wind and finding it elusive. What do power and politics gain for all their toil? So do we say, well, boy, this all of human history is for nothing? This certainly was for nothing. As we keep going in Daniel, we're not going to find any more value in what comes after it. Is all human history for nothing? Well, the struggle for power is for nothing. The building of nations, the lust for glory and wealth, that is all for nothing. You gain it for a moment, and then someone comes along and takes it from you. Or you gain it for a moment, and then you die. And the guy who gets it after you messes it all up, and they parcel it out. It's all of the striving accomplished nothing. And you say, well, certainly this couldn't have been God's plan for history. I mean, this is just chaos, and these men are evil, and they're doing wicked things. But it is, right? Because it was predicted. Daniel was told, hey, this is what is written in the book of truth. Here's all the misery that's going to come. Why is that futility happening? It's happening because this futility is God's plan for history. Turn over in your Bibles to Habakkuk. If you go a little bit farther into the prophets, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, go to Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 13. It's interesting. Hold your finger in Daniel. We're coming back there. Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 13. Habakkuk says, 2:13. Is it not indeed from the Lord of hosts that peoples toil for fire and nations grow weary for nothing? Listen, God's plan for history is for mankind to spin our wheels for nothing, century after century, until it's proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that mankind could not solve his own problems. This is where history is going. Our history today is just part of this huge spinning our wheels for nothing. If you're surrounded by fighting and suffering, know that God is still in control. Even this is part of his decree, and so we can trust him. So if you see our government chasing the wind and our nation laboring and striving after nothing, if you see the world full of suffering and mankind continues in a spiral of selfishness and greed, even then, know God is still in control. This is part of his decree. You can trust him. And you say, well, boy, is there anything of lasting value happening now then? I mean, I know when Jesus comes back, that'll be value. But like now, if God has just decreed that mankind is going to spin his wheels in futility, is there nothing of value that is going on right now that I can be a part of? There is something of value. There's at least two things. There's the glory of God. If you glorify the God who lives forever, that will last. Something else that will last forever, not the kingdoms that are rising and falling right all around us. The thing that has lasting value is the souls of people. Go over to Daniel chapter 2, 12. Daniel 12. At the end of all of this, when the angel gets done with the book of truth, then he gives these instructions to Daniel. Daniel chapter 12, look at verse 2. The angel's still talking to Daniel here. He says, many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake. These to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. Those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven. And those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. Listen, Persia has come and gone. The Seleucids and the Ptolemies, for all their struggling and all of their elephants, they're buried in the dust of history. What remains at the end of it all? Well, the souls of people. The souls of each of these people is going to remain forever. The souls of every person that lives now is going to remain forever. The kingdoms won't. They'll rise and fall for nothing. But the people remain. And everyone is going to be raised, right? Raised to an eternity of bliss or raised to an eternity of damnation. Here's the thing that matters. And so we say, well, what am I going to do with my life? Well, I'm going to build a great nation. Well, go ahead. I mean, that might have some value for a little while. It might help some people temporarily. But that's going to fall. You know it is. We know the end. It just keeps going like this in futility. Don't spend your life building the stuff that's going to fall apart. Instead, spend your life on people. If you can lead one soul to eternity, now you have done something that matters. Oh, you know, Antiochus III, the great, he's not great. If you've led someone to Christ, you're great. That's something that lasts. That's something that matters. So what do? Our worlds, we are surrounded by fighting and suffering. No two things. God is in control. God is in control. And so we can trust Him, even while this spins in chaos. We can trust Him, and we should live our lives for the thing that's going to last. Let's pray. Lord God, we thank You for what You have revealed to us here in the Book of Truth. There's a lot of things we don't know that haven't been told to us by angels. There's things at the end that we know. But we know enough from all of this to know where to put our hope and where not to put our hope. Help us to do that. Lord, it's easy for us to put our hope in the wrong place and to think that the important things are the things of this world, and to think that the things of the next world are kind of secondary, but really that's entirely flipped. Give us the right perspective as we go this week. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.